This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's good in terms of democracy, entrenching democracy and peaceful transitions, but there's also a lot of big problems for the country of Senegal, both politically and also economically.
That's David Monda, professor of political science at the City University of New York, on the positives from Senegal's election. Details coming up. Also, former South African President Jacob Zuma has been disqualified from running to regain his office. And Somalia says government troops have killed about 80 Al-Shabaab militants. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The holy month of Ramadan is a period of reverence and a renewal for Muslims around the world. But U.S. Ambassador to the UN Linda Thomas-Greenfield says this year's Ramadan has been particularly painful for Muslims in Afghanistan, Syria, Xinjiang, Myanmar, Gaza, and Sudan. Focusing particularly on Sudan, the ambassador points out that some 18 million Sudanese face acute food insecurity, with children starving, wasting, and dying. Far from their homes and their communities, millions of refugees are praying in overcrowded camps. Clean water is sparse. Measles, cholera, and other preventable diseases have spread. People in Darfur wake up not to the call of prayer, but to the sound of gunfire. Greenfield points out that a few weeks ago, the UN Security Council came together to adopt a resolution calling for a Ramadan ceasefire. The resolution, she says, has so far been ignored.
Nearly a year since this crisis began, the situation in Sudan remains catastrophic, and it is only getting worse. Right now, just 5% of the UN's humanitarian appeal for Sudan has been met. Already, the World Food Program has had to cut assistance to over 7 million people in Chad and South Sudan.
More than just lacking funding, humanitarian workers, according to Mrs. Greenfield, are simply unable to deliver to those needs. She goes on to say that since the start of this conflict, there have been on the ground often putting their lives at risk to save people in Sudan, and yet combatants on both sides of the war have undermined them at every turn. That includes the Sudanese armed forces, which has impeded the major humanitarian aid crossing from Chad into Darfur.
At the Zamzam camp in North Darfur, a child dies every 2 hours. Experts warn that in the coming weeks and months, over 200,000 more children could starve to death. And so we once again call for the SAF to immediately and fully reopen all of its border crossings with Chad for humanitarian purposes, including the Adre border crossing. Should they not, the Security Council must take swift action to ensure life-saving aid is delivered and distributed, including, if necessary, through a cross-border mechanism.
Finally, the ambassador urges the warring parties to stop the fighting and get Sudan on the path to peace because, she says, the humanitarian crisis in and around Sudan cannot be alleviated until the root cause of the conflict is addressed. Former South African President Jacob Zuma has been disqualified from running to regain his office in the May election. The Independent Electoral Commission, IEC, did not explain his disqualification. Speculation says his conviction and subsequent jailing for contempt of court in 2021 may have played a role. In an unrelated incident, Zuma was involved in a car crash but was not injured. To gain more insight into the current political situation in South Africa, VOA's Poland Diho spoke with Dr. Maropeng Mpia, an advocate and political and social commentator based in Johannesburg.
This has been touted as one of the most important elections we are about to embark on since democracy, basically since 1994. And the reason why it's at stake, it's because people have become disillusioned with the current government and primarily with the president, who seemed to be weak and not being performing to the expectations that he has set to us when he took office. So, and it's the EFF that is coming up. It's Rise Mzansi. There's a lot of parties that are coming up. There's the MK also, the former president Jacob Zuma's party that has come up. So that has made things slightly complicated for the role players that thought they had it in the bag, as it were. So that is the mood on the ground. It's highly contested and a lot is at stake. And the current government, it's polled as possibly going down less than 50% of the voters.
President Jacob Zuma, his party has been barred from even contesting for elections. We also understand that he was involved in an accident. Luckily, he's not. He came out alive.
It's unfortunate. He was going to campaign at a place called Eshowe in the KZN region where he's from. So the MK party and Jacob Zuma have a strong base in KZN. Most of his followers are there. There are some followers in other provinces, but his strongest base is in KZN, and he's likely to do good there.
As a political analyst, you probably know that some things like this that just don't happen just for the sake of happening. On the day he's barred from running in this upcoming election, it's the same day that he's involved in an accident. Could this be a coincidence?
Look, it's an Easter weekend. Some people are partying. It's a holiday. It's certainly possible that it could be just an innocent incident. I'll lean towards the innocent incident because, to be quite honest, Zuma does not threaten the political climate in South Africa. He threatens the ANC and threatens the ANC in KZN primarily. So to a large extent, I wouldn't look at him as a threat to the ANC nationally, but a threat to the ANC in KZN. And whether Zuma is there or not, MK party might have a life of its own and might challenge the IFP, the DA, and the EFF in KZN. He's not banned from running the MK or being part of it. He's disqualified through the constitution, and secondly because he had a conviction of more than 12 years without the possibility of parole. So he's disqualified from running, when in actual fact he would never run for a third term because the constitution doesn't allow it.
That was Dr. Marong Peng Mpia, an advocate and political and social commentator based in Johannesburg, speaking with VOA's Paul Ndiho. The Somali government says its soldiers, backed by international partners and local clan militias, killed about 80 Al-Shabaab militants and wounded dozens more in three operations in the country's southern and central regions. A government statement yesterday said the operations took place across the regional states of Galamodug, Hirshabelle, and Southwest. Deputy Information Minister Abdurrahman Yusuf Adala said the militants were planning spectacular attacks to coincide with an important date in the Ramadan calendar, indicating that the attacks stopped a terrorist operation. There has been no independent confirmation of the death toll reported by the Somali government sources and no immediate comment from Al-Shabaab through its spokesperson or websites. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Tensions continue to escalate between the Southern Africa Development Community, SADC, and Rwanda over the conflict in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. SADC has taken exception to Rwanda's move to oppose its intervention in the DRC by asking the United Nations to deny the mission funding and lobbying the African Union to condemn the operation. Rwandan Foreign Minister Vincent Biruta is accusing the regional force of waging war alongside rebel group Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. The DRC accuses Rwanda and human rights groups of backing the M23 rebels. To discuss the rising political temperatures, VOA's Zimbabwe Service's Blessing Zulu spoke with Professor Kula Telseten, director of SADC's organ and on politics, defense and security.
Let me start by saying, Prof, the recent SADC summit condemned Kigali for its remarks to the United Nations. May you elaborate a bit on this?
Yeah, look, I think it's the remarks that that Rwanda made to the UN in response to the SADC request. The SADC submitted a request to the United Nations requesting support to the DRC. So Kigali submitted a note verbal discouraging the United Nations for its support, basically in the content of the submission from Kigali. That's what SADC was condemning.
But Rwanda, on other platforms, has been saying that the intervention of SADC will actually exacerbate the situation in Eastern DRC. What is your response to that?
Yeah, I do not understand in what way, because SADC is deployed in the DRC, is not deployed in any other country. I don't understand what they mean when they say that, because the situation already is at the boiling point. It has always been like that.
In Mozambique, SADC is actually working with Rwanda, but we are seeing conflicts in the DRC. Are there any diplomatic attempts to try and normalize the relations with Rwanda?
People do not understand. We are in Mozambique, SADC has its own mission. It's a SADC mission. Rwanda is in Mozambique with their own bilateral with the Republic of Mozambique. So those are two separate missions. We are not working with them.
What are the major challenges, if any, that you are facing in trying to bring stability to the region, looking at Mozambique and DRC?
Look, the challenges will always be there, like any other country. And I think the main challenges are the resources. These missions are very expensive to get funding and other resources to keep these missions going. It's a major challenge for not only for SADC, but for any other region. And the challenges also that are posed by you, we all know, we come from a COVID-19 where mainly these missions are funded from the member state contribution. And those member states, at the same time, they also have their own internal challenges. And at the same time, they have to fund the mission. So it becomes a bit of a challenge.
Has the United Nations been helpful?
We can't say the United Nations is not helpful. It has been approached. And we are waiting for the UN to make a decision. I think it's in June this year they will make a decision as to whether or what kind of support they will provide.
But Professor, would it not be more practical for SADC countries to fund their own missions, looking at the fact that there are conflicts in the Middle East and also the war between Russia and Ukraine? Do you think you can get funding looking at those global conflicts?
We are always optimistic that we will get. And I hear what you say. There are more pressing issues that the United Nations and other countries have to face. Any region would like to fund their own mission. But as I said to you, missions are very expensive. There is no contingency fund that is there dedicated to missions. When you want to be involved in these missions, what do you need or what do? We have to tap into the taxpayer's money from various member states, and hence it becomes too expensive. The conflict will never wait for you. You don't know what tomorrow holds for the region. So, unfortunately, we just have to take these missions as they come and try to get funding from member states. But that is a good idea, and it's something that the SADC is really considering, to have a funding we can find somewhere for this kind of mission.
That was Kula Telstein, SADC director of the Organ on Politics, Defense and Security, speaking from SADC headquarters with VOA's Blessing Zulu. Senegal's presidential election almost did not happen last Sunday. The country picked a successor to President Macky Sall, who had been in power for 12 years and had tried to delay the vote that made Bassirou Diomaye Faye Africa's youngest president at age 44. David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the message the restoration of democracy in Senegal sends across Africa.
I think it sends two very broad messages. On one hand, there's the optimism that the election is consolidating democracy in Senegal, and it's pushing back against this wave of military coup d'etats and autocracies, which were very prevalent in the Sahel. But it also reinforces this idea of the value of peaceful transitions of power from the incumbent holder of the office, and that incumbents can also hand power to the opposition. But on the other hand, it also raises a lot of challenges for the new president. For one, he's very young, and that is a positive, but it can also create its own challenges in terms of young leaders sometimes being naive and also wanting to be a little too idealistic to radically change a system that has very powerful power brokers. And he'll also face a lot of challenges in terms of renegotiating some of the mining contracts with a lot of entrenched corporate interests, and also removing Senegal from the CFA franc zone, which Senegal's economy is heavily dependent on France, and the CFA is also heavily entrenched in French foreign policy. So he has opportunities. It's good in terms of democracy, entrenching democracy and peaceful transitions, but there's also a lot of big problems for the country of Senegal, both politically and also economically.
Senegal had never experienced any form of military coup. However, the neighboring Francophone countries were under military rule as a result of unconstitutional change of government. Could the Senegalese experience contribute to countering democracy backsliding in Africa?
I think it could, but we have to understand the history of Senegal. One of the reasons that Senegal never had a coup is because of the very close relationship between France and its previous leaders, particularly when we think of Seda Senghor and the power of the French military over Senegal and over a lot of other Francophone countries. In particular, countries like Senegal were considered what the French called the pays sérieux, right? Serious countries where the French were very, very entrenched and would not allow military governments. So it, in a way, it's good that we have a new leader and there's been a peaceful transition, but also the fact that the new leader is really trying to redefine Senegal's relationship with France from one of a very paternalistic, patriarchal system where France imposes neo-patrimonial leaders, right? These old entrenched leaders that want to stay in power forever. And he's really thinking about a new dynamic of how Francophone Africa and Senegal in particular can reimagine their relationship with the former colonial power. He's given a lot of his initial speeches in English, so that's also a very interesting dynamic in terms of cultural diplomacy. But he's also really looking to try and stamp out corruption and, as I mentioned earlier, remove Senegal from the CFA franc zone and renegotiate some of his mining contracts, which are not always in the interests of Senegal.
But he also wants to break with bad governance via institutional reform. What are the prospects of his success in doing that?
I think it will be very challenging when systems are governed badly. You develop certain cultures and certain traditions of bad governance. When systems are governed well, similarly, you develop good norms and good traditions of good governance. So Senegal has had a lot of challenges and bad governance in terms of the corruption, mismanagement of government resources. And I think he'll really have his work cut out, particularly from two broad dynamics. I think number one, a lot of the multinational corporations that have signed these unfair contracts with Senegal are foreign multinational multinationals. A lot of them are French companies, and they will not want to renegotiate these contracts, at least not the way the new president will want. I think I'm also very concerned about what the individual dynamic, that idiosyncratic relationship between President Faye and the man who was supposed to be president, Ousmane Sonko. How will those two powerful politicians renegotiate this new political dispensation? Because Faye will want to be his own man. He'll not want to appear to be a puppet of Ousmane Sonko. But Sonko will know he is really the man who should have been president had he not been in jail. So it will be very interesting in terms of politically, they're both on the same side right now. But will this honeymoon remain in the long term?
That was David Monda, professor of political science at the City University of New York, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Electric vehicles can lower pollution and save drivers money, but in Africa, uneven access to electricity is a significant barrier to their success. In Ghana, battery swap technologies are offering a solution. Sananu Tord reports from Accra.
Linda Mate grew up with a love for motorbikes. She says she wanted to challenge the stereotype that bikes were for men. However, her first attempt at riding one almost got her injured, so she quit.
Like you can easily get your leg somewhere bent because of the exhaust pipe. When you are getting down and you get off from at that side of the exhaust pipe, yeah, you get yourself bent.
In 2019, Mate was introduced to electric bikes, reigniting her childhood interest. She has since been working as a bike courier in Ghana's capital, Accra. She says electric bikes are easier to operate than gasoline-powered motorcycles. The challenge, she says, is keeping her bike charged.
But with the kind of work we do, the deliveries and stuff, if you charge at home and you're out in town and you run out of battery, then you have to go back home and charge. No.
Instead, Mate swaps low batteries for fresh ones at these stations run by Ghanaian battery company Kofa. Motorcycles play a vital role in Africa, moving people and goods, especially in areas with limited public transport and road infrastructure. Industry experts say e-bikes are cheaper to run and pollute less than traditional motorcycles. But the World Bank says about half of sub-Saharan Africa is without electricity, and even places with electricity would struggle with a big increase in electric vehicles, according to Kofa founder Eric Nygaard.
They are struggling with this in the Western world. So when you plug, imagine everybody comes home at 5 o'clock and plugs their cars in. I mean, what it does is it creates an extreme electricity demand spike, which is quite intense. And so putting that pressure on the current grid systems across Africa would not work.
Instead, Kofa's batteries store electricity from solar panels in the national grid. Users can swap depleted batteries at any time at locations across the capital without putting pressure on the national grid. After 2 years of operation, Kofa swaps about 200 batteries in Accra daily.
And these batteries are almost like packets of energy that you could use anywhere.
Kofa says their batteries can also be used for household appliances and even power generators when the national grid goes down. The company says their batteries could potentially feed power back into the national grid to support the Electricity Company of Ghana, or ECG. Eric Nygaard.
And so let's say you're in an area of Accra that they're going to do like ECG is going to shut it off. Potentially we could support the local distribution network and say we will provide energy from our station to you.
Kofa says they hope their technology will always make energy accessible and drive a quick adoption of e-vehicles in Africa. Sananu Tord, VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.